What would you do if you just had to know how old the stones were in, say, your backyard, or if you found something that looked very, very old? Well, today, science has found a way to date the past with atoms. And to discuss this interesting process with me, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Norman D. Newell, chairman of the Department of Fossil Invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History. Dr. Newell, how is it possible to date the past?
Well, this is a very interesting problem. Paleontologists now have at their disposal two different methods for dating fossils and rocks, and these follow entirely different procedures.
Well, could you describe the procedures then, one against the other?
Well, the oldest of these is the relative method of dating rocks and fossils and depends on their sequence within the ground. The oldest ones lie at the bottom, the youngest ones at the top, so that the dating is entirely relative. The other method is the use of radioisotopes, a relatively new method that provides an absolute date in terms of years.
Using isotopes, how do you do that?
Well, radioactive isotopes disintegrate at a very at a well-known and constant rate that does not vary under different physical conditions. We find that any particular isotope disintegrates spontaneously into another isotope that is not radioactive, in other words, stable. And by determining the proportions of these two substances, the parent isotope and the daughter isotope within a rock, we can determine rather accurately the age of that rock.
That's a fascinating procedure. Well, let's say that I found a fossil or a bone of, well, a Neanderthal man. Just how would you go about determining the age of the bone itself?
Well, of course, the first thing to do would be to classify it, determine the group, the animal, or the plant to which it belongs. And this would be placed then in an evolutionary sequence by comparing it with other fossils that are known from other regions. And the sequence in which these things are known to occur would give us the relative age of that particular fossil. If, on the other hand, there is adhering to the fossil a little bit of radiocarbon, we could make an isotopic determination that would give us the age in years. This is a fairly expensive procedure, but it is often used nowadays with great precision.
You again measure the life or the remains of the carbon element to determine the age of the fossil remain that you're checking then?
This would be just an ordinary chemical analysis that would determine the amount of radiocarbon or carbon-14 that is still present in the material. This is present in all organic tissues.
That's a fascinating idea. How can you be sure that the amount of the carbon was initially or originally at a given level so that you can backtrack into modern times?
Well, this is a conclusion that is based on the analyses of living tissues. We know that all living organisms start out with a fixed amount of radiocarbon within their chemical makeup. And with the passage of time, the amount of radiocarbon decreases as it changes spontaneously into nitrogen-14, which is an entirely different substance. So it's the ratios of the two isotopes that determine the age.
Well, by knowing the original amount, you can check what remains, and by knowing the given dissipation of carbon, you can determine how many years it took to reduce itself to this particular point. Is that the process? I'm not quite sure that I have it right in my mind.
This is all based on the known rate of decomposition. And, of course, almost weekly new determinations are made of the isotopic constant of radiocarbon. And the analyses have reduced the error down to a very small fraction, so that we believe now that determinations on ideal samples can be made within 1 or 2% accuracy.
I was going to ask how you can verify the accuracy of dating over such long periods of time.
Well, there's only one way that that can be done, and that is to have independent checks by different laboratories on materials that are thought to be the same geologic age. In other words, two specimens found together may be analyzed separately, and if they give closely agreeing results, then we believe that the accuracy is rather high. If, on the other hand, the results are quite different, then, of course, we have no confidence in them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Newell, is there any way in which this process might help you, well, identify something that might not ordinarily be identifiable through a cursory examination?
Yes, indeed. Just for instance, no longer ago than about 50 years ago, there were many geologists who felt that the age of the Earth was not greater than about 50 million years. And we had to crowd all of geological history into this short span of time. Now we are in the process of constructing a quite detailed geological time scale with precise dates at various of the episodes in Earth history, so that now we feel that we are on the track of writing a fairly detailed and accurate history of the Earth.
Well, how many years are you anticipate adding to the life of the Earth?
We felt a few years ago that we were quite uncertain about the ultimate age of the Earth. In the last decade, a large number of analyses of ancient rocks and meteorites seem to indicate that our universe originated about 4.5 billion years ago. And we think that it is unlikely that this date will be extended very much in the future. There are changes being made from month to month in the details of Earth history. The exact age of mountain systems, for example, is known to vary from place to place, and the final result will depend on statistical observations. In other words, we'll need dozens of analyses before we feel that we have the particular event nailed down, so to speak.
Dr. Newell, I think it would be good at this point again to pinpoint this procedure of using the carbon element as a dating process. Could you take it from the origin of the carbon itself in the original object we have in mind?
This method of dating the past with radiocarbon has proved especially useful in the dating of human cultures, artifacts, and organic remains, the relatively recent fossils that have tissue still adhering to them. As you know, animals and plants take in carbon with their food, and with the respiration, the plants synthesize carbon dioxide and make tissues. And during their lifetime, there is a continuous overturn of carbon within those tissues. On the death of the organism, the total amount of carbon is fixed. There's no way of adding any more to the body of the animal or plant. And a certain fraction of this is radioactive. That is the radioactive isotope, carbon-14. This is changing spontaneously at a known and absolutely fixed constant rate. Now, during the disintegration or the change of this carbon isotope to nitrogen, there is a continuous decrease in the amount of radiocarbon present. And since the rate of decrease is known, it's possible to analyze a sample and determine the ratio of radiocarbon within the residue that has remained. And this tells us the age in years.
In other words, you might say that you start with the knowledge that, say, a given fossil at the moment of its death contains 100. And if you know the carbon disintegrates, shall we say, one per year, and you analyze it, and there's only 50 remaining, you assume that it's 50 years old.
That's it, exactly. Mm-hmm.
This, it's a fascinating idea. What immediately pops into my mind is, say I brought you an artifact that was made of clay, say, an ancient vessel of some kind. How does the carbon get into something inanimate so that you can check its date?
If it were a piece of pottery, for instance, you might hope to find a little bit of charcoal adhering to it. Most clay artifacts contain shreds of grass and charcoal used in the firing of the pottery. If there is no carbon within the clay artifact, you couldn't date it.
Hmm, I see. You have to have some organic material
that
associated with the item itself. Well, from what you told me, it would seem that this atomic system of dating, though quite accurate in some cases, might in some other instances be a little fallible, as in this case. What about dating, say, an object from a glacial region or some area where there's been an actual movement of the Earth?
Well, this raises a problem, of course. If there have been... If the deposits have been disturbed, if there is a mixture of old and young objects within the deposit, there may be some confusion about what is being dated. With the radioisotope method of dating samples, of course, we are dating the particular object before us and not the deposit that contains it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the standpoint of both archaeology and geology, we're more often interested in the deposit itself, so that the sample must be evaluated in the field. We have to be sure that it is representative of what it is we're trying to determine.
Oh, yes. Well, another problem occurs to me. Since you're basing this on the dissipation of the carbon isotope, would there be conditions whereby this was accelerated unnaturally, say like soil leaching or the activity of underground water? Would that throw the calculation off?
It certainly would. In one case that comes to mind, there has been an attempt to date ancient deposits from mollusk shells. The shells are made of calcium carbonate containing some radioactive carbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these mollusk shells have proved to be rather unreliable because groundwaters tend to modify the carbon in the calcium carbonate and bring a relatively young carbon into the shell, replacing the older carbon, so that the apparent age very frequently is much less than the true age. This is described as contamination. Now, this is not so much a problem with plant remains, such as wood and charcoal.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thought occurs to my mind. With atomic testing and the fallout problem, will there again be, say, deviations in our current organic material, shall we say, that are now growing and living under this accelerated radioactivity? Will this throw calculations off in the future?
Yes, it certainly will. I think, however, that at present, the main source of disturbance comes from contamination of the instruments that are used in the analysis of these substances.
No, I was just curious as to the so much report of evidences of radioactivity and cow's milk and grains and such, whether if, say, 200 years from now you go to analyze, say, grain that is growing today, whether you will still have the dependable figures of absorption and therefore dissipation that you were working on now?
I don't think that this will be an important factor because, you see, in the ordinary radioisotope that's used in dating organic tissues is radiocarbon.
Mm-hmm.
Radiocarbon is not one of the isotopes that is liberated in atomic explosions. On the other hand, keep in mind that we are concerned with the ratio of radiocarbon in the tissues at the time of death.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no, apparently there is no modification of the ratio of radiocarbon to non-radioactive carbon after death.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is such a fascinating thing. I'm curious, as since this is relatively new, when actually would you say is the beginning of this type of atomic dating?
It started in 1907 when Professor Boltwood of Yale University first demonstrated that rocks could be dated by analyzing the ratio of radioactive isotopes in those rocks. He used a mineral of uranium called uraninite for his determination. And it all started with him.
Then, of course, we have, you have, men in the science, had prior to that date pretty well associated fossil remains with a given era. What exactly new has this added to your knowledge of, say, the step back of time?
With all of these wonderful new developments, we sometimes forget that the geological time scale was worked out in great detail before Boltwood made his discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, I think that the great advance has been in pinpointing various episodes in Earth history and determining the number of years that have elapsed since these happenings.
Well, in other words, it was well established, you might say, sequence, but you didn't know exactly what year it was that the sequence took place.
The relative dates were known, but not the mm-hmm. absolute dates.
This certainly opened a new facet then for, has it altered any ideas?
Well, yes. For example, we find that some geologic periods were twice as long as we had thought. Others were half as long.
Oh.
So that there is a progressive sharpening of detail, and we feel that our history is much more reliable than it was before.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Norman D. Newell, Chairman of the Department of Fossil Invertebrates at the American Museum of Natural History. Typical American teenagers, boys in high school, boys with interests and hobbies, active social lives and family ties, decide to spend another day pursuing one of their active interests, paleontology, the science that deals with life of past geological periods based on the study of fossils. As they had in the past, they set out for a quarry on the west side of the Hudson River. Eager youngsters scurrying around the shale and rock excavations of the quarry, intent and purposeful, nevertheless. They discard many pieces after a careful examination, but the day is young. Perhaps they will find something yet. Suddenly a piece is picked up, and the knowing minds of these youngsters grasp the importance of this fossil find. Not sure of what it is they have, they take it to the American Museum of Natural History, where they had been working after school. Staff members of the museum identified the object, and the world was enriched with further proof of life on Earth 175 million years ago. We have the pleasure of welcoming the three young men who unearthed this rare fossil: Alfred Siefker, Joseph Geiler, and Michael Brandowski. I wish also to welcome Dr. Edwin H. Colbert, Chairman of the Department of Vertebrate Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History,
who has come to talk with us about this most unusual discovery. Doctor, may I, in my most active curiosity, ask you first, what exactly did the boys find? I mean, what is the physical description of the fossil?
This fossil is a skeleton, the fossil remains of a skeleton, of a gliding reptile. A little reptile about 7 inches in length, as we know it, in which there were considerable specializations of the skeleton. For example, the ribs in this fossil are very greatly elongated, and they must have supported in life a membrane, which formed a sort of a flying wing with which this animal was able to glide from one tree to another. It's a beautiful and a very delicate little specimen.
And only 7 inches.
Well, that's the length without the tail. The tail mm-hmm. is not really preserved in the specimen. We only have a few vertebrae of the tail. I think the tail was probably long, and perhaps in life this animal may have measured a foot or so in length.
I was just thinking of the curiosity of the boys' research in finding such a small object.
Yes, well, of course, a great many of the fossils found from this quarry are small.
How old do you estimate the age of this particular fossil?
This fossil is found in rocks of Triassic age, which means that in terms of years, it's about 175 million years old.
I don't wish to sound impertinent, but how do you as a scientist arrive at a given age for a fossil? What processes do you use?
It's a sort of a process of round robin reasoning in a way, but we know the ages of the fossils from the ages of the rocks in which they're found, and we know the ages of the rocks from studies that have been made within the past few decades of the disintegration of uranium into lead. And it's by the study of the proportion of uranium and lead in particular rocks that we can date certain rocks. And having dated certain rocks here and there in the geologic record, we can date the rocks in between, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. In other words, you establish age by association.
Yes.
Well, how does this new specimen that the boys found fit into the historical record that we already have, you know, as people know it?
You might say that this new fossil extends the record. It's an addition to the record, and it opens up new vistas in our knowledge of the evolution of the reptiles of long ago.
Does it fit in as, you might say, a missing link in the story?
It's not exactly a missing link. It's something different. Different and quite unexpected.
Well, what makes it, actually unique in this?
Well, I think it's unique because it is, in the fossil record, the first indication we have, so far as I know, of any backboned animal that ever took to the air. And, of course, in an air-minded age such as we live in, that is of particular interest, I think.
Well, you say...
It extends the date of flight back, you might say.
Oh.
Although this wasn't a true flying reptile, nevertheless, it went through the air. And so it's the oldest animal, too, indulge, you might say, in aerial progression or aerial locomotion.
That is strange. You referred to it as a gliding fossil.
That's right.
Were these gliding reptiles the ancestors of the later flying reptiles?
No, I don't think so, although I suppose flight was established first by gliding, but this reptile was not in the least manner an ancestor of the true flying reptiles that we know, because, as I said a moment ago, this reptile had the ribs elongated to support a sort of a membrane, you know.
More like a
flying squirrel, you might
say.
Whereas the true flying reptiles had the forelimbs adapted or specialized to form wings, you see, so they could flap the wings. This animal could not flap. He only glided.
His entire body would spread out.
That's
as
right.
A delta wing.
That's right.
Approach.
And in that way, he could glide. And as a matter of fact, there are lizards at the present time that live in the Philippines and in the East Indies that have a similar adaptation, in which the ribs are elongated, and there's a membrane, and they can glide from one tree to another, and they can glide for considerable distances, I might say.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say that the modern find, or today's gliding reptile, could perhaps be a descendant of this fossil?
No, it's not a descendant. We can see that by the anatomical relationships of the things. This represents an independent development of a similar specialization. And in evolution, that's what we call parallel evolution, where two animals or two plants evolve in the same way, and yet they're not related or only distantly
mm-hmm.
related.
Do you have any knowledge now that this fossil found by the boys might have a current ancestor?
Well, I don't know. At the present time, it's an isolated specimen. We do know, I think, the fossil types from which it was descended, I think it was descended from land-living reptiles of primitive aspect. But we don't have any connecting links as yet between this and the animals that may have been its ancestors.
Well, they've opened up a new door to a new room of research, haven't they?
That's right. And, of course, in time, perhaps we'll find the links or the other connections that help to fill in the story.
It certainly makes an exciting discovery.
Yes, it does.
I should like to talk with the young men who are responsible for this find, a find made possible through their own knowledge of paleontology, knowledge sufficient to recognize something unusual in that field. And first, I'd like to talk to Alfred Siefker. Alfred, what school do you go to first?
Memorial High School.
And how old are you?
17.
17. How in the world did you ever get interested in a field not generally associated with a 17-year-old American boy, paleontology?
Well, it was about 4 years ago when one of my friends told me there was a quarry in North Bergen. And we went down there one day, and while we were there, I overheard a boy say to his friend, "Let's look for fossils." So I decided to follow them out of curiosity. And he picked up a coelacanth fish, and I just became quite interested in it after that day.
Are there many other fossil hunters over there with you?
Not many, but off and on there are mineralogists and other paleontologists and amateur collectors at the quarry.
Well, it sounds like you've got yourself started on a very interesting subject. Would one of you boys be good enough to tell us just how the fossil was found? How about you, Mike?
Well, it was one of our regular days. We did the usual work. We dug down to the layer to about 3 feet of dirt and matrix mixed. And we cleared a surface area of shale, about 4x6 square. And we found the reptile right near the edge of the layer that we exposed. We didn't expect it at all there because it was near the end and the matrix was fairly wetted.
You have, I can see, sufficient knowledge to know where to look. How long have you been digging in the quarry?
Well, I myself have been out there almost 2 years with Alfred since I met him.
Well, Alfred, back to you. How did you know that this particular fossil of not too large a size, only 7 inches as it stands, how did you know it was something unusual?
Well, it was very strange looking, and we had immediately seen these elongated ribs, or they were fairly exposed to the matrix.
And from your knowledge of other fossils, you figured that this was unique and unusual?
Yes.
That's a good mind and a good eye there, too. I'm sure I would have passed right over it, and perhaps many people have passed over important discoveries without knowledge to see it and find it. And how do you prepare something that must be so fragile?
That's a very difficult task, and I would like to emphasize that Mr. Gilbert Stucker, one of the technicians in our paleontological laboratory, has done a magnificent job of preparation. And preparation of this particular specimen has been aided by the development of some of the new technology in our field. We have used a machine that uses a blast of carbon dioxide with an abrasive aluminum oxide or powdered dolomite, and have prepared the specimen that way, never touching the specimen with steel tools, you see, because it's so very delicate. And, of course, such preparation makes the specimen more meaningful. Finding the specimen is only the first step in a long process. It has to be found, then it has to be cleaned and prepared, which may be a long and tedious operation, after which it has to be studied for a long time, and it's the study and the publication of this specimen in scientific publications that makes it meaningful, makes it significant in the field of science.
And you pass on one more page that is then in the book of every knowledgeable man in that field.
That's right.
Well, do all of the fossil finds, as I understand it, without knowledge of it, it is an actual object. It's not the impression
of a... Well, fossils may be of various types. Most of them are the actual objects, but they may be impressions, molds in the rock, or, of course, you may find footprints, which are fossils, too.
But this that the boys found was the actual object
this
that you're
preserving.
This
is the fossilized skeleton, that's right.
I didn't realize that Jersey was such a center point of fossil finding. Is that true, Doctor,
well,
generally?
Well, quite a few fossils have been found in New Jersey in the Triassic rocks there, all up and down what we call the Northern Valley of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a great many more fossils would have been found except for the fact that Much of the rock is covered by vegetation, and nowadays much of the rock is covered by buildings.
So the New Jersey Turnpike, too.
That's right. But the rocks in New Jersey are of the same age as rocks in Arizona and New Mexico, where a great many fossils are found,
I didn't realize that. That's not true, then, of New York.
Well, not these particular rocks. New York has many sediments that contain fossils, but they're older, for the most part, in age.
Mm-hmm. You boys said that you have worked after school at the museum. Now, what are some of the jobs you've done or become involved in?
Well, we work on the same machine that the gliding reptile was cleaned up with. We clean up the other fish fossils we collect at this quarry, the coelacanth fish, and a few other specimens that we have found there. We clean them up on this machine.
Well, you're learning the process of completing the task, as the doctor said, finding it's only the first step. This in itself would be a highly technical career for you, wouldn't it?
Yes.
In preserving the fossils that are found even by other people?
Yes, it takes a lot of skill to clean up these fossils on this machine without destroying any of the bones.
Like a watchmaker.
Yes, it's a tremendous task.
Joe, are you specializing in any particular work at the museum?
No, well, just regular paleontology, collecting fossils and bringing them over.
I was just wondering if you were branching off into any particular skill.
No, fish fossils and reptiles.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, are you working or apprenticing right now at the museum in any special field?
No, I do about the same work as Alfred and Joe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like an intriguing idea to where youngsters can take their curiosity or a hobby, pursue it, find satisfaction, and do it well under the guidance of such an institution as the American Museum of Natural History. Doctor, do you have many students in this venture, not necessarily in paleontology, but perhaps in other subjects?
Well, of course, there are students. We get inquiries from students all the time. And as a matter of fact, the American Museum of Natural History is a training ground for graduate students in these fields, in cooperation with some of the universities in the metropolitan area, so that we have a rather well-defined graduate program of study at the museum.
In my, again, simpler curiosity, I was wondering if people, interested youngsters in this field, could get further information from the American Museum about pursuing, perhaps as a hobby or a study of their own.
Well, we get letters all the time asking this very question. Mm-hmm. Of course, we try to answer them to the best of our ability.
Dr. Colbert, I want to thank you for being with us and for telling us about this exciting discovery. Alfred Siefker, Joseph Geiler, and Michael Brandowski. And I want to thank you, as does the scientific world, wish you great future success in your chosen fields of endeavor.